expenditures is open. We are going to discuss three of the larger tax credits today, the Earned Income Tax Credit, Cultural Trust, and Ag Worker Housing Construction. So we have some people lined up to come up as on panels, and we have our LRO expert, Kyle, to talk about each of them. Let's do one at a time here, Kyle, and start off with the biggest one on the menu, which is the renewal of the Earned Income Tax Credit. If we were to renew it just the way it is at its current level, that'd be about $54 million a year. And so it's the entree on the menu. Kyle.
Okay. Good morning, respective chairs, members of the committee. So yeah, I'll just start by drawing your attention to, or letting you know, of the materials that we have up in OLIS right now. Again, everything's under the meeting materials because there's no specific bill that's uploaded. But so what I have there for each of the three credits that are to be discussed is an excerpt from the report that Legislative Revenue Office put together. That's the background report related to tax credits that are up for sunset review. So there's a section for the Earned Income Tax Credit, the Cultural Trust, and then also the Agriculture Workforce Housing Construction Credit. So there's three different documents up in OLIS related to each of those. That it's about five or six, seven pages that give some of the background, the policy purpose, and also some analysis of the effectiveness of the credit. And then, so that's what's up there right now. And specific to, I was thinking just to kind of set the stage for the earned income tax discussion. Again, Oregon's earned income tax credit is connected to the federal earned income tax credit. So Oregon's is just a percentage of the federal earned income tax credit. And that's beneficial in some ways in that it incorporates all the administration of the federal earned income tax credit. And the chart that you see up on the screen, this is from that excerpt of the report, is probably the best way to visualize how the earned income tax credit works. So again, the credit is focused primarily, it's most helpful to taxpayers that have children, and again, they have to have earned income to receive the credit. And there are different amounts of the credit based upon the size of the family or the taxpayer and how many children they have. So what you can see there is the first line, the blue line there on the chart, is for a taxpayer with no children. Again, this is the Oregon Earned Income Tax Credit amount. So the benefit for a taxpayer with no children is pretty low. And again, this is keying off the federal one. And then as the number of children go up, the potential benefit from the credit goes up. And as you can see, the credit is structured to increase initially as a taxpayer's income, earned income, goes up. There's then a plateau period. And then as income continues to go up, the amount of the credit then begins to phase out slowly over the income brackets that you can see there. So that's the general structure of the earned income tax credit. Again, there's more information contained in the report. Happy to discuss in greater detail if you'd like, but that was what I was thinking for just a quick overview of it for now.
Any questions of staff? Rep. Smith Warner.
Thank you, Chair House. Not a question, I just wanted to say, Kyle, we see so many charts that take a lot of time and thought to figure out, and I just wanted to compliment you on what a fantastic, easy to understand, completely intuitive chart this is, because that is not easy to do. And this is a complicated program that you really easily convey in one very fast and easy to understand chart. So, great job. Thank you.
Okay. Let's bring up Alicia Temple, Dan Hahn, and Howard Kenyon. Welcome.
Good morning. Co-chairs Haas and Representative Nathanson. My name is Alicia Temple, and I'm from the Oregon Law Center. And just going to talk very briefly about the Earned Income Tax Credit, what some of the research shows about it, and how it impacts families. I will say that I talked with Chris Allen yesterday, and you know, he said he wanted a very academic overview and not to do the advocacy. And I just want to caveat that the research is really positive, so it might sound like advocacy, but I promise this is what the research shows. So as Kyle said, the EITC has a lot of variables about marital status and children, and that chart that he showed, it really can vary. So broadly, I'm going to talk about averages, the plateaus that we talked about. So the EITC has a really really unique and pretty perfect structure where it slopes up and then that plateau. So if you are a family of married and have two children, so a family of four, that plateau happens from about $14,000 of earned income to $24,000. So that's when you get the max benefit from the federal and the Oregon EITC. The amount that you can get in that benefit can really make the difference for families to bring families out of poverty. It's just enough to get you over the federal poverty line often. So that is a really significant plateau feature. And then as it slopes out, you are never worse off with the EITC. So for every dollar you earn, you lose about 40 cents. And it's a really gradual slope. Again, for that family, I guess the average ending point is about $40,000 to $54,000. So again, depending on all the variables of your family and your marital status, that's when the EITC can end, when that gradual process out. So it's uniquely designed. It's been around since 1975, so there's a lot of research about what the EITC has done. Oregon made our percent match in 1997. We matched it at 6% in 97. In 2007, we made it refundable so that families could get money back. In 2013, we moved it up to 8%. That's the last time the EITC was up for renewal. And then in 2016, we added the child boost. So that's where if you have children under three, you get an 11% match of the federal rate, as opposed to the 8% that other families get. In Oregon, that's the families that are eligible is about 300,000 families. That ends up being 900,000 Oregonians that receive the EITC. And 129,000 of those families are lifted out of poverty. There's a 16% reduction in our poverty rate in the state because of the earned income tax credit. It brings in, let's see if I can find the exact number. I believe it's $612 million to the state of federal funds. A lot of that goes to more rural districts where there are higher rates of poverty. I submitted for the record a variety of reference documents, and one of them has the information for each of your districts about how many people in the earned income tax credit, how much money that means comes in from the federal government to help benefit the economy. For every dollar we put into the earned income tax credit, research shows about $1.4 is spent in benefits the economy. One thing I wanted to highlight, I know that the budget that was originally discussed for tax credits broadly was $40 million. As Kyle said, to simply renew the earned income tax credit, it would take $55 million. So if we were only to spend $40 million on the earned income tax credit, that assuming we didn't fund other tax credits with that funding, so there's a lot of assumptions there. But $40 million would... There are a variety of things you could do, but in reality, it would eliminate the boost for kids that we put in 2016 and would drop our rate down to about 6.6%. So that takes us back closer to where we were in 1997 than where we've been since then for families, if that's the change we were to make. That overall reduces Oregon's EITC and the benefits to families by 25%. Average federal EITC that families get is $2,900, and then the average Oregon match is $233, so that's about the 8% of that $2,900. That doesn't include children with families because we don't have that data yet for average numbers, but the research really shows that getting cash into people's hands makes a difference. That sounds like a kind of silly thing to say, but when you are looking at families that are making, say, that $14,000 to $24,000 a year, getting $2,900 or $4,000 makes a really big difference. Research shows families spend it on things like car repairs, going back to school, training, paying off old debts. The Oregon Law Center has a lot of clients that use it to prevent eviction, can kind of back pay rent, public utility bills, those sorts of things. In the materials that I submitted, there are a couple documents about return on investment, and the one that is from the Renew and Raise Coalition. Janet Bauer from OCPP put together this really great document with links to every study of each of these facts. And I just want to highlight a couple of them for you. I think my favorites are all in the children section about how this impacts children and how they succeed. And one is that there was a study on infant health and the EITC, and it shows a really significant increase in or reduction in low birth rates, up to 10% reduction in low birth rates, particularly for Black mothers, with an increase in the EITC. And then there's also information about how children that receive the EITC or in families that receive the EITC have a lifetime higher achieve earnings potential. That's based on about a $3,000 EITC, which if the average right now in Oregon is $2,900 federal, we're pretty close to that mark. So that's making a really big difference in families' lives. The last thing I want to say is the thing Chris asked yesterday when I was talking to him about what to tell you all, he said, is there a magic number? What should the EITC be? Does research show that? I'm going to tell you what the research shows, and I don't think you're going to like it, because ultimately a lot of these studies say are based on if people got $1,000 more. That's what a lot of the research looks at. For Oregon's EITC match rate to be 1,000, we'd have to increase it by 25%, so it'd be about 33% match of the federal EITC. That's actually right in line with what a lot of states do. One of the documents I submitted shows the chart of what all the states currently are matching at, and Oregon's at the bottom of that list. A lot of states do 20, 25, 30, yeah, here we are. Those kind of higher numbers. So it's not unreasonable to imagine that someday we could get there. I know that's not the conversation we're having right now, but I think regardless, an increase in the EITC gets us closer to what the research is showing for how we can be benefiting families. The last thing I'll say is for every percent we increase the EITC, it's $30 into families' hands. And so, you know, if we were trying to get families additional $90, $100, we could increase it by 3% to be able to do that. Or we could look at the different rates of kind of boosts for children, different combinations of things. And that I think the way I think about it is for every percent, we get people $30, and that can really make a difference for families. So that's just a really brief overview of all the research. There's so much. I only highlighted one of the studies, but you do have that doc and links to all of the research there. I do know there's a new one, actually, that's not on that document that just came out last month, about a market decrease in suicide rate with the EITC. And nationally, it estimates 1,200 suicides are prevented through the EITC. So that one's not on the document, but I could send that because that is a new study that's out there recently. Thank you.
Excellent overview, Alicia. Mm-hmm. Yes, Rep. Marsh.
So we're over here very interested in how California manages to do an 85% match.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about limited eligibility?
Yeah, so I'm not an expert in the California match, but I do know that they cap it differently. So I think it's 85% up to, off the top of my head, I'm going to say it's about $20,000 of income. And then they don't have this kind of slope after that in the same way.
Gotcha.
But it is a little misleading that it's on the chart, which is why we made sure to caveat that they do it slightly different.
Representative.
Thank you. Ms. Temple, you mentioned that it was a 16%, I want to make sure I got this right, 16% reduction in the poverty rate because of the EITC. Is that correct? And then I just wanted to clarify, is that because of Oregon's EITC, or is it because of the Oregon and the federal?
The combined Oregon and the federal.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
Okay, gentlemen.
Co-chairs Senator Haas and Representative Nathanson, for the record, my name is Dan Hahn. I am the Deputy Director of the Self-Sufficiency Program at the Department of Human Services. It's very rare that a social worker gets to come talk about tax expenditures, so I really don't know a whole lot about tax expenditures. What I do know about is poverty, and what I do know about is the impact that the tax credit and cash coming into individuals in poverty's hands does to help them with their journey out of poverty. So the Self-Sufficiency Program runs the TANF program, the SNAP program. So TANF, Temporary Assistance to Needy Families, need to be below $616 a month in order to be eligible for that program. So that comes out to less than $8,000 a year in order to be eligible for that program. So you're really talking the most severe poverty for families. We also have the SNAP program, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. That's what we think of as food stamps. And so those individuals are below 185% of the poverty line, which for a family of three is about $38,000 a year. We also run the employment-related daycare program that provides assistance with childcare costs for those who are working. In addition to that, we run some other programs. But when I think about the programs that we run, especially TANF and SNAP and the individuals those serve, those benefits are really earmarked for very specific things, especially the SNAP program. Those benefits are earmarked for food. They come on a card that is really, in most cases, only able to be spent on food. There are some exceptions to that, but it's very, very, very rare. And very small community, very small population that gets a cash benefit, and that's really related to not having access to services. And then you look at the TANF grant, and the TANF grant is only $506 in cash for all of what someone needs. And so you look at that $506 in cash benefits, and what does that buy someone? It doesn't even buy someone a two-bedroom apartment anywhere in this state. And in order to get to that level of income, you need to, I just did a presentation before the Housing Committee, it's like for the fair market rate of a rental property, the closest one was like Baker County, and you still needed to add $200 to that 506. And that's only income that, that doesn't include anything else that someone needs to live on. It doesn't include toothpaste. It doesn't include any hygiene products. It doesn't include any food. It doesn't include anything like that. So we're really talking about the poorest of the poor. What the earned income tax credit does in a state where 20% of our workers make less than $12 an hour is it gives people a lump sum and an ability to actually do some of those things that Alicia talked about. Actually, while Alicia was going through her talking points, I was crossing mine off. So it really gives people that opportunity to do some of those things that everybody who is working needs to deal with from time to time. Transportation issues, car repairs, tires for your car, being able to put first and last month deposits down on places, being able to, unfortunately, back pay your utilities often, back pay your rent some of the time. So that earned income tax credit really is a complementary services to the things we provide. We often hear that it's redundant, and I really don't believe that it is redundant. It really is that thing that allows people to often stay employed and stay connected to the workforce. It's closed for school. It's, like I said, the car repairs, the rent. It's just really an opportunity for families to invest in things that keep them moving on the right path. Self-sufficiency, we realized a couple years ago, we changed our mission to include connection to careers out of poverty, as opposed to just being a safety net and just providing family stability. And then the thinking behind that was we really need to give people the opportunity to attach themselves to ways to make income. And I think as they're doing that, like Alicia said, a tax credit will often help them access skills training. It's not that individuals who are making $12 an hour don't have a work ethic. It's that they don't have the skills that are needed in the communities that they work in and live in. And so the earned income tax credit really gives an opportunity for all kinds of things that can help people get to that next step and work their way out of poverty. So that's really all I wanted to talk about today. I think Howard has a much more convincing story on the earned income tax credit and what it did for him. So I think, unless you guys have questions, I'll turn it over to him.
Thank you. Howard.
My name is Howard Kenyon. I live in that wedge of Portland where Senator Haas is our senator. And thank you to our co-chairs, Haas and Nathanson, and the rest of you for inviting us to come. EITC has been a lifesaver for my family and me, and because this is personal testimony, I prefer to read it because it brings back memories. So if you ask me how my family could have benefited from a higher level of help from EITC, there is no doubt. Those were lean, hard years in which we are still in the process of catching up. To set the stage, have a PhD, and had until my early 50s, I'm 63 now, 64, excuse me, creeps up. Until my early 50s, a successful career leading an NGO in China, supervising a team of more than 100 international and local personnel. And in 2007, for health reasons, my own health reasons, my wife and I returned to the U.S. and settled with our four teenagers in Portland, buying a house. We bought the house in May 2008. Then, just as the Great Recession hit, we had to resign our international position and start looking for work locally, work that was not to be had, work of any kind. Tapping every resource we could, including all our retirement, all of it, and going far into debt, we came within 4 months of losing our house and moving out of the area to live with our parents just to survive. And I must say to you that moving in with my in-laws when I was in my 50s with four teenagers, I assure you that had never been on my bucket list. Finally, in mid-2010, my wife and I found part-time work. Our retired parents remained generous with their help. I became a client of the food pantry I managed. Food pantry is Northeast Emergency Food Program. But with a combined income of $42,000 a year, we were still losing ground. And then a friend, who happened to be a tax preparer, recommended I look into EITC. And for that season in our lives, EITC became a lifeline that stayed at our bank accounts and got us through. Gradually, our income rose. My wife went back to school to earn her MSW from Portland State and went on to be a SunSite manager for ERCO, working with low-income students. Currently, she's at the Rose City Park Elementary. I am now vice president of Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon and represent that organization on the Oregon Hunger Task Force, the Oregon Food Bank Advocacy Committee, the local emergency food and shelter boards, as well as the Oregon Complete Count Committee. Our kids have been graduating from college and becoming gainfully employed, actively serving those less privileged, and I'll just brag for a moment as a dad. My oldest was in the Army. He's now in the Washington National Guard. My second, Stephen, will be ordained as a Catholic priest on June 15th with the Portland Diocese. My third, Hope, is a campus pastor with the Assemblies of God in Corvallis. And my youngest, Hannah, just graduated from college last year and is now a pre-K teacher at Portland Christian Center in Portland, Oregon. My wife and I are still in Oregon, happily paying it all back through taxes, nonprofit engagement, and volunteer work, serving others whose lives have followed similar paths into those valleys where you don't know how you will ever get out, no matter how hard you work. People who, like us, can make it because of EITC. Thank you.
Thank you, Howard.
Congratulations on the success of your kids. I always think that success of kids is a reflection of the parents. Questions of our panel. I don't think I've ever seen in all the years I've been here on this issue anybody come up here and say this isn't a good idea. So we're in that situation where we often find ourselves, we're a little stuck and we're still searching for solutions here. So really appreciate your putting this into perspective for us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Kyle, let's move on to the cultural trust.
Okay, Mr. Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, the cultural trust, again, there is that excerpt. There's the PDF of the excerpt of the report up in OLS. But what I would just call your attention to kind of set the stage here is the cultural trust example, which is up in OLS as well. And it's just describing an example of how the credit works. I think that probably does a better job than going through the whole description. So we'll get that up in just a second. But the idea of the cultural trust credit is it's really two stages. You make an initial donation, and that's going to be a donation to one of Oregon's 1,400-plus cultural 501c nonprofit organizations. So these are cultural organizations. A taxpayer would make a donation. And the example I have up there is just they make a donation of $1,000 to this 501c3 nonprofit. Now, that initial donation can qualify as an itemized deduction as a charitable donation on someone's tax return. Now, where the cultural trust credit comes in is the second donation then becomes available to the taxpayer where they can then donate to the cultural trust. There are limits on the credit. It'd be $500 or $1,000 for the donation, but it has to be also less than the initial donation. So in this example, this taxpayer makes a $500 donation to the cultural trust in the same tax year after making that donation to the Oregon cultural nonprofit. That taxpayer then qualifies for a $500 Oregon credit. That's the Oregon Cultural Trust credit. It is non-refundable. It's non-carry-forward, so that the taxpayer to benefit from the credit will need tax liability. And then in addition to that, Oregon allows that $500 donation to the cultural trust to be claimed as an itemized deduction. However, that is not allowed to be claimed on a federal tax return. And that was clarified by the IRS in some information that's put out some, I guess it wasn't really a rule, it was a clarification last summer, making that explicit that because Oregon has a credit for that donation, a taxpayer can't claim that $500 donation to the cultural trust on their federal return, but they can still claim the initial $1,000. But again, that's just an example of how the cultural trust credit works. Again, it is a two-stage process, so you need that initial donation first, and then the secondary donation to the cultural trust is where the credit comes into play.
Okay, can I get you to do another example? Give us a hypothetical with actual circumstances.
Sure. Is it okay?
The second step of this.
Yeah, so the second step of this, and this is, again, this is through maybe using the Cultural Trust's website and as an example. They do have a list of all these cultural organizations so that I can help if someone's searching for different ones to support. You can find your initial donation there, and then you go through and make that donation. You're writing that check, I guess, specifically to the Cultural Trust, and then the Cultural Trust use those funds on cultural organizations and projects throughout the state, and that's what I believe Brian Rogers will speak to more of how those funds are used spread throughout the state. But in some cases, that's a way your first initial support might be for a specific nonprofit you have in mind related to culture. And then the second, where the donation tax credit comes in, the donation to the cultural trust then supports culture in general here in Oregon.
I don't think a lot of people are familiar with the way that two-step works. The first, you have to make I can't just make a $500 cultural trust donation and expect to get this. I have to first make a contribution to the Oregon Historical Society, and then I'm qualified to do this cultural trust donation for which I get a tax credit.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, that's the key step, as it is first donation, and only after you've made a donation do you even qualify to make this secondary donation for which you can get a credit.
Okay.
Yes.
Senator Rising?
So is that first donation still deductible in federal tax return? Okay.
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
Okay.
Rep. Marsh.
Thank you. Kyle, can you just clarify for me, is the second donation proportional to the first donation? I mean, here you have 1,000 and 500, but could you make it as much as 1,000 if that was your initial?
Yeah, Representative Marsh, it would depend. It is limited to, for an income tax, a personal income taxpayer, it's $500 for a single or $1,000 for someone who's filing a joint return. And that was part of the reason I picked that example, is just to give a sense, it is limited to what you can get that credit for. So if the initial donation was $500, then yeah, it'd be $500 and $500 for a single filer. Yeah, but it was just to kind of highlight that it is limited what your match or what your credit could be for that matched donation. It has to be, if you donated, say, $200 for your initial donation, then the most you could get on the credit side would be a $200 donation to the cultural trust.
And regardless, the most you can get is a $500.
$500 or $1,000, yeah, if you're married, okay. Filing jointly, yeah.
Okay, Brian Rogers.
I'm trying to figure out.
You could send those five, but you're still maxed at the five to per year. Okay. Yeah, so like four to 250.
Chair Haas, Chair Nathanson, and Vice Chair Finley, and Vice Chair Marsh, and committee members. For the record, I'm Brian Rogers, and I have the pleasure of serving as the Executive Director of the Oregon Cultural Trust. And I'm also the executive director of the Oregon Arts Commission. And thank you for this opportunity today to present an overview of the Cultural Trust. The Cultural Trust is unique. No other state has a tax credit program like ours. It was created in 2002 by the Oregon Legislature, and the trust is a testament to how much Oregonians value culture and its impact on our famous quality of life. The Trust's mission is to lead Oregon in cultivating, growing, and valuing culture as an integral part of our communities. The Cultural Trust supports House Bill 2132 to extend the sunset for the cultural tax credit for contributions to the cultural development account for another 6 years. Today, I would like to briefly cover the following items: the economic impact of arts and culture in our state, an overview of the Cultural Trust program, and a description of the donation and tax credit program and the impacts of the federal tax reform. And then I'll close with a few grant impact stories. In 2017, the Arts Commission and the Cultural Trust partnered with the Americans for the Arts to conduct one statewide and 12 regional arts and economic prosperity studies. The studies provide compelling evidence that the nonprofit arts and culture sector is a significant industry in our state, one that generates $364 million in direct industry economic activity. The spending by nonprofits and cultural organizations and an additional $323 million in event-related spending by their audiences supports 13,939 full-time equivalent jobs. Total attendance at arts and cultural organizations was over 9.9 million, and those attendees spent $323 million, excluding the cost of event admission. In 2015, a total of 36,750 volunteers donated nearly 1.6 million hours to Oregon's arts and cultural organization, and the estimated aggregate value of that was $37.5 million. The trust is an ongoing funding engine for culture across the state. Through the tax credit, the Cultural Trust raised $4.8 million in 2018 from over 8,800 donors. Last year, we also received $374,000 from the sale of 13,169 license plates, funds which are currently designated to support our marketing efforts for promoting the tax credit and supporting culture statewide. 60% or $3 million of the funds raised through the donations was allocated to our grant-making programs, and 40% or $1.8 million was placed in the permanent fund for future generations. The Trust's direct grant-making program, called the Cultural Development Program, has four categories and supports cultural projects across the state. In the last biennium, 177 projects received direct grants, and there is a list of all of our grants and OLIS. Awards are determined through a peer review process by a peer application review panel to adjudicate applications using very specific criteria. Each year, we also fund the county and tribal coalitions. There are 45 in total. Each coalition, a county or a tribe, receives a block grant from the Cultural Trust. And last year, those coalitions made 473 local awards for a total of $600,000. And a list of the awards is also in OLIS. We also have the privilege of providing funding for our five cultural partners: the Arts Commission, Oregon Humanities, Heritage Commission, Historical Society, and the State Historic Preservation Office. To fund these programs, the Cultural Trust encourages Oregonians to donate to one or more of the state's 1,400-plus cultural nonprofits, then donate a matching amount to the Cultural Trust. The matching amount to the Cultural Trust can be then claimed as a 100% tax credit, up to $500 for individuals, $1,000 for couples filing jointly, and $2,500 for C-class corporations. I'd just like to take a moment and talk about the current donation status, especially in light of the federal tax reform on our decreased marketing budget. In 2017 and 2018, the trust raised $4.8 million from 9,180 donors. Currently, we're experiencing a $428,000 reduction. That's 7.5% reduction in funds raised, and a net loss of 989 donors, or about 10% of our donors. And this is a graphic representation of the trust fundraising over 11 years. And on average, as you can see, we experience about a 5% growth rate each year from 2009 to 2018. And this year, again, we are receiving, we're seeing a reduction of 7.5%. And early reporting from the National Council on Nonprofits is showing that charitable giving rose about 1.6% across the country from last year, despite a pace of inflation of about 2.44%. Giving normally is expected to grow in the order of 3 to 5%. And contributions over $1,000 increased by 2.6%, but there was a 4% reduction in contributions of less than 1,000. And again, as a reminder, the maximum contribution that is eligible for a trust tax credit is $1,000. Some individuals are also using donor advised accounts to distribute funds to nonprofits. These funds from these accounts is technically from the donor advised fund and not the individual, and therefore is not eligible for a tax credit. Additionally, some individuals are doubling down on donations, meaning they give to, they are giving to nonprofits every other year to reach the minimum itemization on their federal tax paperwork. In the year these individuals are not giving, they probably won't give to the Cultural Trust. So the trust, we're planning to survey those donors who typically donate but did not this year. And over the years, we have experienced a fairly high donor retention rate, and we would like to research why close to 1,000 donors did not participate this year. It may be the real or perceived impacts of the federal tax reform, and or it may be the result of our reduced marketing budget. Typically, we remind people via postal mail and email reminders in conjunction with a fairly substantial marketing campaign. These activities were reduced due to a very limited administrative and marketing budget. The budget in fiscal year 2017 was $420,000 for marketing, and currently it's $195,000, which is a $225,000 reduction. The reduction was caused by a reallocation of personnel expenses that were formerly assigned to the Oregon Arts Commission budget. Additionally, the trust admin budget is capped at $400,000 a year. Last year, the trust worked with the economic consulting firm Econ Northwest to compile a report on the impacts of the cultural trust and the tax credit. The report analyzed data from 2006 to 2016. The trust donors, as you can see, are located throughout the state, and the map on the left shows the number of unique donors across counties. And roughly 52% of our donors come from Clackamas, Multnomah, and Washington counties. While the majority of those donors reside in those three counties, 60% of our funds are dispersed outside of those counties. The aggregate number of contributions received by the trust since its creation is 115,000, with a total of over 55.5 million raised over those years. The two maps show the geographic reach by county of total funding through the two grant programs that distribute the majority of the trust funds, cultural development grants and the county and tribal coalitions. You can see that the trust grants reach all corners of the state, and counties with larger populations typically get larger amounts of funding, but funds per person or per capita are highest in the eastern part of the state, where populations are smaller and more dispersed and fundraising is more difficult. Just like to provide two brief impact stories for trust-funded programs. In 2018, the trust grant funded the Southern Oregon University's Foundation Young Artist Institute for at-risk or low-income students. The multidisciplinary 10-day residential summer program served 46 students from 16 school districts in 9 counties. The grant also covered financial aid for close of half the students who otherwise would not be able to attend. And one student said, "I learned to put myself out there, take risks, write as much as possible." And another said, "I learned to create shamelessly, to be unafraid, and be okay with bad first drafts." The Cultural Trust funds are also supporting the renovation of the historic Baker Orpheum Theater in Baker City to become a community performing arts center. It first opened in 1889 as the Orpheum Theater, but in 1956, the theater was closed and sat vacant until about 1964, when it was remodeled into a hardware store. Later, it was a clothing store and then a music store before closing in 2015. In May 2016, the effort to restore the building and reopen it as the Baker Theater began. Much of the original decorative features will be revealed after being hidden behind false walls and ceilings. The building chair, the building committee chair, Althea Bonebrake, credits the Cultural Trust grant with opening doors for future grants from funders like the Oregon Community Foundation. And what is pictured here is a recently approved design rendering of the theater's new marquee. So I'll conclude there, and thank you very much for your time today, and I'm pleased to take any questions you might have.
Rep. Nathanson.
I'd like to clarify something with Legislative Revenue Office. There have been some references in the earlier presentation and also in this one, referring to a donation in the singular, like a $1,000 contribution. But I think the way it works is you could make contributions to the museum and the ballet and the symphony up to $1,000. Could you please clarify if that's the case?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I was just reviewing statute on that as well. And the way it's been written, it was thinking in the singular, but it seems like if you were making four $250 donations, and perhaps Brian can correct me if I'm wrong, you wouldn't be required to then make four individual match donations to the Cultural Trust. I think you could just make the single $1,000 donation. There wouldn't be a requirement of that one-to-one match. So, yeah, I think it would be a cumulative.
A sum.
Okay. Yeah.
Thank you.
Kyle, Brian mentioned possible reasons for the downturn last year was the IRS change, and you referenced that too. Is that your hunch as well?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that's one of the things we're definitely keeping an eye on. I wish we had more information at this time. We're still waiting for that first year, full year, and we'll see what the fallout is from that IRS change. And there's a number of other credits this and the committee is probably aware of as well that are in a similar situation where the federal benefit or lack thereof has been clarified, and we'll see what could be possibly happening. And again, there was other changes in the Tax Cut and Jobs Act as well that Brian was talking about that could have changed people's behavior on how they're making donations as well, which could be especially affect this credit if they're doing that every other year to maximize their itemized deductions right. for that initial donation to the 501c3 nonprofit.
Brian, you said that the Eastern Oregon Building grant you made opened the door for other grants, and in my work with foundations, I've seen that dynamic before. How often does that occur with How often have you seen this with the Cultural Trust?
It happens, excuse me, Chair Haas, it happens very frequently that the trust is, because we use a statewide panel to adjudicate applications, we're oftentimes the first funder into projects to help things get started. And they could use that as leverage to say, I think the Baker Theater got a grant somewhere between $35,000 and $40,000 from the Cultural Trust. And they were able to use that to apply to the Oregon Community Foundation and be successful there. And subsequently, they were able to apply to other funders as well. And I think real importantly, it motivates communities to not only donate time and energy, but also to donate to, things like the Baker Theater to get the community involved in it, to say, hey, a statewide entity values what we're doing in our community. I should too.
Yeah. Questions of Brian Rogers? All right. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming, Chair. Kyle, agricultural worker housing.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the agricultural workforce housing, sadly I don't have a chart or anything specific that I could sum it all up in one page. So again, there is that background document that's up there in OLIS, but to just try to describe, to set the stage for this credit, again, it is a credit for the construction of agriculture workforce housing. The credit amount is 50% of the eligible costs, and it could be construction or rehabilitation as well of this housing. The credit structure, so it's 50% of those eligible costs, and the credit structure sets it up that it's going to be claimed, we would expect at minimum of 5 years, because there is a limit. You have the total amount of the credit that's linked to those eligible costs, and then the credit amount that can be taken cannot exceed 20% in any year. So if you take 20% each year, it would take you 5 years at minimum to take it. And then there are carry forward provisions as well. So it can really spread out the use of this credit from when the initial certification was received from the Department of Housing for building or rehabilitating these properties. There is an overall limit. So there's an overall annual limit certifications of $7.25 million. So again, because it's the overall certifications, the credit is half of that. It's about $3.625 million in credits per year that can be certified. What we've seen in the data over the past few years is the actual claiming of this credit and the use of this credit hasn't kept up one-for-one with that certification. We have seen an uptick, and that's up on the screen now, an uptick in the use of this in the past few tax years that we have data on. And again, our data is quite a few years back. So we'll begin to see, that's one thing we're keeping an eye on as well, is because this credit can be claimed over a number of years and there's potential for carry forward, so there's quite a wide window on the number of years from when a project gets certified and built and when it actually claims on the credit. We'll be keeping an eye on how this use keeps up with the amount certified. But again, this dynamic is contained in the impact estimates you see for extending the cost of the credit.
And the credit is 20%, 50%?
50%.
Yes. And that was 20 and was raised to 50 a few years ago, I think.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, in that background document.
Yeah, there it is, from 30 to 20 to 50.
At the very, the very last page, there is a description of the different changes since enactment. And, you can see how the credit has changed over time and the amount of the certification as well, how that's changed and been increased in certain years.
Jonathan Sandow and Peter Hanley.
Morning, Chair Nathanson, Chair Haas, members of the committee. Jonathan Sandow with the Oregon Farm Bureau. Thanks for the invitation to come to you this morning to speak on behalf of this tax credit. It is a longstanding tax credit, first brought into, or first enacted in 1989. So we have 30 years of good use of it, good show of what the tax credit worked for. I'm not going to go through and kind of go through the mechanics. You guys just heard it, and it's up there on the stage or up on there on the screen, so I'll be pretty brief. But the 50% of that credit is widely utilized across the spectrum for both on-farm housing and then community-based housing, which Peter can speak a lot more in detail to. And, like it was mentioned, it's for new construction or substantial remodeling. And so it really allows for the farmer, to build these housing on the farm or community-based folks to try to attract and retain good quality workforce, but then also to invest inside that workforce as well. Since 2001 to 2012, we've seen about over 1,200 units be constructed utilizing this tax credit. We have about 830 of the community-based ones and then just over 400 on-farm use. And that really, I think, shows the shift from kind of the on-farm worker camps and worker on housing to the community-based ones, which, again, Peter can talk to as well. The unique thing, I think, around this one is definitely the coalition that has been built in support around this credit. Bakun, the Nurserymen's, Farm Bureau, CASA, and then the fruit growers, the Columbia Gorge fruit growers, who represent a lot of those growers in the Hood River Valley, where most of this housing stock is found. We all came together. This is a critical tax credit, I think, for a lot of our members. And I'll just point a little towards Senate Bill 114, which is in the consideration stack. That one contains a second tax credit that we would just like for a little bit of a consideration that would go towards operation and maintenance of existing housing stock, because there is a little bit of a gap where the construction tax credit can't really be utilized for kind of the upkeep, whether it's weatherization or modernization of the current housing. And it's a similar style where it's 50% of the cost incurred. It can be for the maintenance or the utilities, so that's the operations end of it. This one was Senate Bill 1 in 2017, so some of you might remember the negotiations there between Senator Courtney and Senator Thompson. We have one of the things with the utilities part on that, just real quick, is that there a lot of folks charge almost no rent or very low rent for this housing. And so, but the utilities is a cost to the workers. And so by you know, just with that credit, it would bring some money back into the workers' paychecks. But just wanted to note that's in Senate Bill 114, which is again in that larger stack. But overall, I mean, I think tax credits have been a long utilized tool by, you know, government and these public bodies in general to show, you know, incentives to encourage outcomes. And I'll just say that this session started, I think, you know, kind of around the housing topic with, you know, a lot of the considerations with affordable housing and rent control and things like that. And one of the populations that we believe is routinely underinvested in and under discussed in the larger housing conversation are the men and women that work on the farms. And I think that this tax credit is kind of a nod to the probably one of the most hardest working groups here in Oregon, and just kind of showing that the housing conversation also extends to those folks, and that we are paying attention to that. So I think I'd refer to carry it over testimony on specifically Senate Bill 114, because that has some good presentations on kind of the projects that have been done both in here in the Willamette Valley, but then in Hood River. And there's by a few members who have really detailed some pretty outstanding housing projects there. So we understand the constraints that this committee is under when it comes to consideration for all these tax credits. And so we really do stand by the construction end. If there is any additional resources to maybe pilot the operations one, we would certainly appreciate that consideration. And I'll just note one quick thing that I caught in the in this report, that it does say that DOR kind of interprets the sunset to avoid the carryover credits. So I would, you know, I think that renewing that this tax credit, you know, is good on its own merits, but then also to continue to invest in those projects and not jeopardize the current ones that are relying on those tax credits going down the further year. So with that, we'll let Peter go, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Good morning, Chair Nathanson, Chair Haas. Peter Hanley, Executive Director, Costs of Oregon. Since 1988, we've been serving the farm worker community, building housing and other services. We also offer match savings accounts via IDAs, and we help co-op or make co-ops in manufactured housing parks. All of our programs tend to serve low-income rural populations and a particular focus on the farm worker community. Since our inception, we've been working with housing authorities, growers, as well as nonprofits to develop farm worker housing. We've worked in approximately 60 rural communities, created 43 different projects. Those have been manufactured housing parks, they have been single family housing, they've been multifamily housing, and housing approximately 6,000 farm workers and their families. You know, the most recent Census of Agriculture showed that the ag industry is about $5 billion. Our diversity of crops means that they're very labor intensive, and probably half of that $5 billion requires significant work on the behalf of farm workers. I would just like to say, you know, on behalf of the 180,000 farm workers and their families, and that's counting both year round as well as migrant and seasonal. Migrant seasonal is estimated at about 30,000. They're screaming for housing right now. They're doubled and tripled up in a lot of private housing. There's not as much on-farm housing because of OSHA standards. OSHA standards have been recently revised, and folks that are running those labor camps are gonna need to update those camps. And so we're gonna need to continue working with the growers in the rural communities to upgrade housing, to build new housing. We use this tax credit to leverage federal funds from the Department of Agriculture. That's a program specifically for farm worker housing. And it's probably the last federal program that actually has new money coupled with rental assistance so that the farm workers don't pay more than 30% of their income towards housing. And so this is a crucial piece of the leverage that we need to be able to put those projects together. I just want to thank the committee for the work that you're doing and the hard choices that you have, and would appreciate support of this continuation of this tax credit. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter. Questions on ag housing? Rep. Nathanson.
Thank you. I don't have a question, but I have a comment I'd like to make now that we've reached the end of our presentations for this morning. As Senator Hass has pointed out, a number of very worthy efforts and programs that we try to provide assistance for. We can't afford them all in our current budget. We're working on that. We're trying to figure it out. But meanwhile, one of the things that I think a lot about is our use of tax credits instead of funding programs and having things go through the regular budget process. There are some things where, whether it's agriculture, workforce housing, or some of the other ideas that are not necessarily related to taxes. At some point, someone found it to be a very convenient mechanism to offer a tax credit. But some of these things are also, I think, just as appropriate for a grant-type program. And we run some very successful grant programs through Business Oregon, for example, where we provide assistance for projects. And Business Oregon, it might seem surprisingly, handles grants and loans for things not related to economic development also. For example, I think the seismic retrofit for schools goes through Business Oregon, the funding for that. So as we ponder which credits we, is that correct?
Correct.
Thank you. So as we ponder what can we afford this year and committing ourselves to ongoing years, I hope people don't lose heart and don't give up. If you have a good idea, it may be that it's appropriate for the legislature to consider funding this in some other mechanism, because tax credits are not the only mechanism to achieve the goals that we have in mind, the objectives of the types of programs or projects that we'd like to provide assistance for. And grants, unlike tax credits, are scalable according to market conditions or social and economic conditions that face us in different ways every 2, 4, and 6 years. So we'll keep thinking and we'll keep working on all of these. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. Committee, if you want to review the list of tax credits that are renewing, it's on OLIS. It's the first one there. It's JCTE 523. And when you go there, you'll see these numbers haven't changed. It's still $68 million. Of renewals in the 1921 year, and that's only 1 year. That's because these sunset in the middle of the biennium, but you'll see it's roughly double plus growth in the following biennium. As of today, we still have no more than $40 million authorized to spend on that $68 million, or I should say $40 million plus whatever we might be able to find in existing tax credits or tax revenues. So that's still our charge, and so far I've heard some suggestions on where to go for those other tax credits, but so far no proposals, so that's where we are. So keep your thinking caps on, reps, senators. This will be an omnibus bill, whatever we end up doing, and what I want to go to next is what else will be in this omnibus bill. And after 3427 was passed by both chambers this year, literally within hours after it passed out of the committee, came the need to do some technical clarifications on that rather complex measure. And so those technical fixes, if you will, are also going to be included in this omnibus tax credit bill. And so we have about, I don't know, 8 or 9 categories here, and Chris Allenack will walk through them ever so briefly, because we could spend the next hour just on banks. Mm-hmm. Chris.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. And for the public, in OLIS, there is a document called the Omnibus Bill, which is what's up on the screen here. It's what I'm referring to. And it's just broken out. It's a very high-level overview, or basically a list of what we're thinking will be in the bill that the chair has just described. Part one would be the tax credits. There's no detail there, but the committee is just starting to review that list, so that will be developing over the next week or two. And then part two are what we've labeled technical and clarifying fixes. And there is the list here, just very briefly, banks and insurance, as the financial insurance companies, as the school funding bill was being developed, we knew that there'd be additional work on those, so they're on the list. There's been a lot of confusion around the language on agricultural co-ops. We're working with advocates to clarify that. And dealerships, there were some wording issues about how the tax might apply to them and interaction with the privilege tax. And there was ongoing discussion about residential subcontractors, and then also economic development, capital investment. There are just discussions around language in the bill that may or may not get to some of those policies. And then seven, what I have there is a definition clarifications for telecommunications. There are actually a number of places where the definitions in the bill need to be modified or tweaked just a little bit. I mentioned telecommunications. There are 3 or 4 related to those, but that's also a theme where the definition needs to be just clarified. Number 8, local taxes on meals. I'm aware of a couple of communities in the state that have this kind of tax, and one of the themes in the bill is that any tax collected is not part of commercial activity. The taxes on these meals wasn't included in that bill, so it would be included in that theme. This is basically any local tax or any entity that collects a tax and then remits it to a government, that amount of tax is not part of that entity's commercial activity and not part of their tax base. The liquor store language, this is one where the liquor stores, because of their unique situation, I think we might need to tweak some of the wording in there just because of how those entities are run on behalf of the state. And then other, there are a handful of, in some cases, literally a one-word change or clarification. And so rather than listing all of those, that's kind of the other category. And so that is, in very brief fashion, some of the things that we're working on right now, or that are in the mix as of now.
And I should have said this beforehand. For the most part, these are all non-revenue issues or clarifications. Nobody's getting an exemption or carve out here, for the most part.
Correct.
Yeah. Any questions on that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a question. So is it your expectation that we as a committee will do this, or is the Joint Committee of Student Success Revenue Committee going to do this and feed them into this bill?
We will do it in this bill.
Okay.
The language, we've all been working on it for 3 weeks now, and the language is being drafted for most of these now, still being finessed, I think is the word that LC would not use, but so it should be ready. And my hope is that none of these will be controversial and none of them will cost anything. Yes, Rep.
There's a bill that's currently, I think it's sitting in the hopper of the House Revenue Committee, and it's a grocery definitions and some of those. And I'm not sure how many legs it's got. But there's some definition issues in here on groceries, or in 3427 on groceries, that they don't sync very well together. I don't see groceries on this list. So is that
Well, we happen to have the House Revenue Chair right here.
There is a bill in House Revenue which doesn't need to move forward now that we have got something else.
And that's what I was thinking. I was just trying to see, not particularly for this one, but whether it needed to go through and tie into this. But groceries is not on that list as well.
Okay. You're lucky nobody's asking you about the insurance language.
I want to see what it looks like first.
But I guess we don't have a, and in terms of following up on the drafting, we're still working on language, but we're still also, we don't have a vehicle yet for to get an amendment out to actually have an amendment drafted. We're still working to identify that.
Okay. Well, things will probably continue to get more into focus in the coming Fridays, especially the next two Fridays. So thank you all. And if there are no further questions or no further business, we will adjourn.